You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Alrighty, Blake, here we are. This is episode 41. Who do we have on today?
This week, we have none other than the CEO of Greenpeace and a Carlton supporter.
Ooh.
Yeah, I know. I know, but we still got him on. David Ritter.
David Ritter. Fantastic. Hey, it is a beautiful day here in Melbourne.
It is.
By the time our listeners are listening to this, it could be very different weather. We're in the loft in your house.
We are.
Which is our studio.
Would you call it a loft? You just did. Let's just go.
Well, what do you call it? The upper deck?
I'm not sure what we call it, just upstairs. But let's go with loft. Yeah, we're in the loft.
There's not much on the walls, though, I've got to say. This room needs a bit of decoration.
Yeah, it does. I was actually talking to Amelia about that the other day.
What were you thinking of putting up?
A couple of mirrors.
Just mirrors. Just so you can look at yourself.
Well, we tend to do a bit of exercise up here.
Oh, this is the home gym.
It is, yeah.
That would explain the kettlebells I can see in the corner.
There it is. Yep.
What did you have on your bedroom wall? Because these are stark walls up here. This is something else.
You're having a crack at our interior design?
Maybe.
Yeah.
There's an unplayed guitar. Actually, no, it did get played in episode 40.
The guitar?
Yeah, Danny Walsh.
There's been a bit
of that. It's the best sound that's ever come out of that guitar. But these walls are bare.
They are.
What did you have on your wall when you were a kid?
I had a number of things on my wall. As you know, I'm a big Hawthorn supporter. So I had some posters of Hawthorn players.
Who was your favourite player?
My favourite player was Peter Knight. It's number 24. You know, big splash of blonde hair, leap over the pack. He was on there. But I had this massive poster, must have been 1.5 meter by 1.5 meter of just Darryl Braithwaite's head.
What? Just his head?
Just his head. And as you walked into the bedroom, his eyes locked on you. And for some strange reason, it didn't matter where you moved in the bedroom, his eyes followed you.
Wow. That's
odd.
It is odd.
It is odd.
Yet you kept it up.
I did. I, what a band they were, Sherbet.
Yeah.
What's your favourite Sherbet song? Do you know one?
I don't know one.
How's that? Remember that song? You're not old enough.
No, maybe not. you need to tune into Gold 104.3.
What about you? Who'd you have on your wall?
Well, I actually had pictures of planets.
You didn't.
I did.
You were that kid.
Yeah. Maybe a bit too much on the nerd side.
Gee, not a lot's changed.
No.
But do you think I
had planets and stuff like that because I found that stuff really interesting.
Yeah.
Did I think I was going to become an astronaut?
Mm.
Maybe not.
Yep.
Did you think you were going to become a lead singer in a band?
Rock star. A rock star?
Yeah.
I absolutely did. For a very short period of time. And I also thought that I was going to be a VFL at the time or AFL footballer for a very, very short period of time until I discovered I had no talent in either of those areas. There you go.
Well, unlike our guest today, who you'll find out what he had on his wall.
This is amazing.
But he didn't actually think, oh, no, I'm definitely going to become, involved in Greenpeace, you know, especially at the level that he is. But it's an amazing story of someone who's found their passion and is walking it every day. And as you'll hear, David skips to work every day. That's how much he loves this. And that's why this story is so good for our podcast.
Here is the CEO of Greenpeace, Carlton supporter, brilliant writer, David Ritter. This is part A of our conversation with the CEO of Greenpeace, David Ritter. Once you're done with this one, move on to part B of our conversation with David Ritter.
You sound like a robot.
I do. Why am I talking like this?
Hey, Blake, before we get stuck into this episode, where should our listeners go if they want to hear more stories of people doing?
they should jump onto www.thedolanders.com.au. And what will they find there, Nick?
No, not .com.au, Blake, just .com.
Oh.
Don't make that mistake. You can hit us up on Facebook. You can hit us up on Instagram and our website, and you can find a whole heap of pictures, articles, links.
Recipes?
Not a ton of recipes, okay. But you just never know what you'll find. TheDolanders.com, no.au.
Do it.
Okay, now, from the beginning.
You're a cult supporter.
Oh.
I mean, don't judge me for this. You don't choose your football club.
That's true.
They're given to you.
Anyway, that was David Ritter, CEO of Greenpeace. Let's wrap it up there. Anyway, how are you, David? Welcome to the Dolanders. Happy Friday. How are you feeling?
Happy Friday to you. Look, I'm. It's great to be chatting. It's good to be with you. Feeling good.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Nick, how are you? It's a beautiful, beautiful Friday morning here in Melbourne.
It sure is. And, well, podcast listeners, you won't be listening to it today and you can't see me, but I am getting a suntan. Right
you
now.
Are. You are through the window of our studio. Hey, David, thank you so much for carving out some of your precious time. We love to ask our guests, first up, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking. I'm 49. I turned 50 in just a little over a week. I'm Australian by origins and by where I live. I'm a dad to two kids whom I absolutely dote on. And I'm married to, someone who I've loved dearly for 20 years. And I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Greenpeace Australia Pacific.
Nice one. There's a lot in that and we'll dig into that shortly. But what I want to know, in a week's time, the big 5-0, what's the plan?
And our invite hasn't arrived yet, no. David.
Well, look, no one's invite's arrived. To tell you the truth, it just hasn't.
Oh, that's a relief.
The house is coming. It's to sort of plan anything because of COVID. So I've sort of put any real marking of the milestone on a bit of a hold until we know with a bit more clarity what's going on with the pandemic.
Okay, celebrate a little bit later on in the piece. Hey, David. Okay. I'll just let it slide. One or the other. Before the podcast, we send to our guests a pre-recording brief, and you have dutifully sent that back and filled it in with absolute precision. And you attached a couple of recent articles or essays that you've written. You're one of those people that has this amazing ability to arrange words on a page that can take the reader to the exact place that you want them to be and to conjure up the exact emotions and provoke thought that you want to provoke. And it is, it's a gift, and it was reading that was so transportive. And I'd love to explore a little bit about of that today. You recently wrote, "In truth, Greenpeace has always been both a movement and a thing, a machine that is nothing without its spirit, an essence that is given focused force by the strength of institutional capabilities. The object isn't to stop bad stuff per se, but to create the conditions to grow, build and nourish the good." You know, I reckon I'm positive that all of our listeners know of Greenpeace, but I'm pretty sure they don't know all of what you do. Can you tell us a bit about Greenpeace and what you do?
I'd love to. And the truth is I've loved Greenpeace for a very long time. I had a picture of the Rainbow Warrior on my wall when I was a kid. I mean, there's no predestination in that. I had a picture of Alan Border on my wall and a picture of Blondie on my wall, and I didn't grow up to become a cricketer or a pop star. But I loved Greenpeace because it epitomized for me a kind of vision of what the world might be, and a kind of an assertion of what really mattered. And it always struck me that, you know, it wasn't the foundation of this or the society of that or the organization of the other, but built around that vision of let's make it a green peace, which is literally where the organization got its name from. Someone calling that out at a meeting, a little over 50 years ago. And so what the organization and the movement, and it really is those two things, at once, What it is an international, independent environmental campaigning, organization. And all of those things are crucially important. Mm-hmm. The international, you know, we genuinely are a deeply integrated, global organization that means we work on the Great Australian Bight, but we also work on the Arctic. We work on Antarctica, on the Amazon, but we also work on pollution in big cities or on the depths of the oceans. So a truly global organization.
Yeah.
That is resolutely independent. So we never accept any government or business sponsorship ever. And that gives us that unbridled capacity to be able to speak truth to power without fear or favour. And we are an environmental organisation. It is fundamentally about that beautiful mission of securing an earth capable of nurturing life in all of its magnificent diversity. But within that environmental mission is also a real cherishing and love of people. So there's a real justice imperative built deeply into the Greenpeace ethic as well. I love Greenpeace since I was a kid. When I was still a commercial lawyer working in Perth, I used to kick in my $30 a month to Greenpeace as one of the many supporters that makes the work possible. And I still sometimes pinch myself to find that here I am working for the organisation 13 years in, and when I'm not working at home, when I'm in an office, I still genuinely find myself almost skipping to work with the sheer enthusiasm of being able to work for this thing that I genuinely love, for a mission that is of such profound importance.
That's a brilliant way to live, isn't it? Like, if you are skipping to work, I had Daryl Braithwaite on my wall, and
no judgment, mate.
No,
I'm now. Oh, no, we're judging.
I'm now thinking, geez, I wish I'd had Blondie on my wall. But anyway, but you, what a great way to live. You're embodying, you know, what you grew up with thinking about, and if you're skipping to work every day, it's an amazing thing. And the work that you do is amazing. Greenpeace was founded on this idea of agape. Can you explain what that means?
Well, agape is a kind of publicly directed love. So it's not the kind of, you know, love you feel for your partner or you feel for your intimates. And it's certainly not a kind of possessive love. It's a love for the world. It's a love that recognizes that nature is inherently beautiful and transcendent and embodies something of importance that can't be just expressed in terms of material value. And it's a love that recognizes the innate and miraculous value and qualities of every human being. So it's an outwardly directed love. And when that kind of love informs a campaigning organization, it means that rather than being out to campaign, you know, to win or to dominate or to be driven by ego or for power or riches or glory or something, that you're campaigning in order to shift vested interests from love and out of love, which means you're not seeking to dominate. You're just seeking to enable the flourishing of people and nature. It gives us an almost peacefulness, a sort of sense of peace almost that underlies all of the work, whatever the sound and fury might be involved in the day-to-day drama of campaigning.
Thank you for that. Look, it's really interesting if you switch on the news, you pick up a newspaper. I talk to my 10-year-old son, and you know, there's a lot of messaging that you often wonder and consider, is there hope to turn this thing around from a global warming perspective anyway? Before you answer is there hope? You recently wrote something. I'd love to read it if you don't mind. And it goes not for too long, but for a little while. It really helped me think about the framing of that question: is there hope? So it's a hot Australian twilight some years ago now, and I'm among a couple of hundred people who have gathered in the forgettable, sanitised space of a function centre conference room to talk about the future of life on Earth. The formalities have concluded and everyone's risen from their chairs. As the furniture scrapes and most of those that have attended begin to begin their patient procession towards the exit, some members of the audience make their way forward to approach one or other of the speakers. You probably know the drill. I've done this often myself when there's someone I really want to meet personally. On this occasion, though, I've been one of the panelists, and as I remove the lapel mic and pick up my steel water bottle, a modest gaggle of forms for a chat. I have a quick and friendly exchange with one or two of these waiting for a word before a youngish teenager takes his turn. I guess he's, I don't know, 14. He's got pale skin and nervous brown eyes behind the glasses. The stubborn russet hair and rangy physique give an open expression to the not yet quite fitting together parts of mid-adolescence. It is still years before Greta Thunberg and the dynamism of the global school strike movement and how it will fundamentally change the demography of international climate activism. So the kid stands out. He speaks hesitantly with an instinctive sideways glance as if wishing there was no others present to overhear what he was about to say. I have the sense that he is straining not to show too much emotion. There's a kind of cauterized look about his face, perhaps just shyness, maybe more. An uneasy beginning verging on a stutter before he asked me bluntly, "Is there any hope?" And you said?
Well, I said, yes, there is. But that moment was a very striking moment for me, because it did feel a bit as if the earth opened up. And it felt that way because it's the first time I can remember in my time as the head of Greenpeace in Australia and Pacific, it's the first time I can remember someone very directly posing the question to me in those terms, in that kind of way. And, you know, particularly this was a kid. This was a kid. And I felt unready, and I felt a sense of obligation in the moment to someone who was making themselves vulnerable with me. And it just was one of those instances when time feels like it's going very slowly, and you feel you sort of live quite a while you're wondering what to say. And in the half second or whatever that it was in which I sort of gathered myself, I then, you know, I looked him in the eyes, and I think I probably put one of my hands on one of his shoulders, and I said, you know, words to the effect of, yes, of course there is. And I've had that conversation, or variations of that conversation, with many people many times since. And it's not a dimension to the role that I have, the vocation that I have, that I'd envisaged was going to be part of it. But it's a consequence of the acceleration of the climate emergency and the broader ecological crisis, combined with the willful and despicable negligence of Australia's government and many of the other governments of the world, and indeed plenty of business leaders too, and made more manifest, of course, in the summer of the Great Fires, when 35 million hectares of Australia burned. And the point about these kinds of conversations is that there's nowhere to run internally, because we face the crisis of life on Earth, with the same kind of existential, question hanging over it as you face your own mortality. So, I and I think many others have been into the cave of pondering what the crisis of life on Earth means, what the climate emergency means. And I suppose for so long as the best scientific analysis that we have is clear that we can get through this climate emergency with so much that is beautiful and precious still intact, and the ability to rebuild, to recover, to regenerate beyond that. And because we know that if there's one thing we know, it's that human beings working together can achieve practically anything. I retain really an iron faith, if you like, that we will get our act together and we will get through this. And there is a fundamental obligation upon every one of us to equip ourselves well, as a friend of mine put it to me recently, to do our utmost to ensure that that is the result. But none of that means that there won't continue to be terrible loss along the way because of negligence that's already in the bank, because the oil companies did tell the lies, because the politicians implemented the lies, and we haven't yet taken the action we need to get to net zero. So that the journey of balancing hope through action with experience of loss is going to be the journey of our generation.
Yeah. I mean, you're in such a unique position with what you do. You would see the worst of this situation, but you'd also be privy to see some of the best things that are happening. You know, when we spoke a little while ago, you talked about Spirit of the Fires, the Albert Park Kindergarten, and, you know, another organisation that's working together to zero. Like, tell us a bit about that and how that inspires you to keep doing what you're doing.
Oh, yeah, look, I'd love to tell you about that. But first, I'll just pick up one little thing, which is that I engage with this stuff every day, but I'm not, you know, I'm not in the position of someone who lives on an island that's a meter above sea level. I'm not in the position of someone who's, you know, had their town destroyed by a fire or a tsunami or something. I'm not a 90-year-old person living in a flat in Penrith without air conditioning. So, you know, I'm reading a lot about it and I've seen some stuff, but you know, I just want to acknowledge that I'm not on the front lines in the same kind of way. And also it is a very, very great privilege to actually have a paid job for an organization you love to fight your nightmares, which is what someone said to me very early on. He said, well, you know, congratulations, Rudy, you've got a job fighting your nightmares. And it is true. And that is genuinely a privilege. But it is also a privilege for the reasons that you just mentioned. The extraordinary sources of hope. And it is always hope through action. You know, hope is not a wishful thing. It's not just about manifesting an attitude. It's about action, and it's action on the biggest scale where you can exercise influence. So you mentioned the story of the Albert Park Kindergarten, and I love that story so much because it was an inspirational lead educator and a sort of group of other adults around her who went, well, what's the biggest thing we can do? Well, it's shifting the institution that we're part of and then using with the Albert Park Kindergarten and then using that institution to influence others. And look, I tell you, when I went to sort of visit them, and there's these 4-year-olds marching past with their backpacks in kind of, you know, orderly process. And, you know, the tears were in my eyes at this sort of moment of hope through action. And then you mention the fires, and you know, there was an extraordinary spirit in this country at the moment of the fires. 80% of Australians had a direct experience of extreme climate damage through the fires, whether it was either, you know, running from the fires or, you know, in the case of some, tragically losing their lives to the fires, losing their homes to the fires. And then, of course, there were people inside cities experiencing the most toxic smoke on the toxic air on the planet in Australia. So 80% of us had some kind of direct experience of that severe climate damage. But emerging from that was this extraordinary spirit of the best of who and what we are. It was a spirit of kindness, of generosity, of community, of bravery, of common endeavour. And there are so many moments in the course of that when you just sort of, you know, you look round at your fellow citizens and you're proud of what people are doing, and you're proud of that response. And one of those, belatedly, is, you know, it came a couple of weeks ago, and I went to have a chat to one of the communities that had survived the fires, and talking to a couple of people. And one of them was a bloke who sort of told me the story of how he'd been standing in his jocks on a hillside, you know, sort of waiting for the fire to come. he sort of thought, oh, you know, better put some clothes on, sort of thing. And, you know, later he finds himself, with a group of his fellow community people waiting for this fire to come over the hill. And there's this sort of roaring that people describe, the sort of sound so loud you can't believe. And he said to me, you know, I knew then that we were ready for that fire. And he said, but what that experience has told me is that as a community, we are ready for whatever comes over that hill. And I just thought, That is the spirit of this people in this country. And then in a completely different set of circumstances, but just a couple of days later, I was with the CEO of Coles, and they were launching, their new policy following a concerted Greenpeace campaign, their new policy to have zero dirty power, so 100% clean electricity across all their Australian operations by 2025, which is massive. It's the equivalent of every home in Tasmania going solar overnight.
Wow.
And now the announcement is together to zero. And I'm just standing there and I'm thinking about the fella saying, you know, we are ready for whatever comes over that hill. And, you know, this other context of a business saying together to zero. And I'm thinking, this epitomizes what we need to meet this challenge in this country. It's a historic collaboration of community and capital. And it's a kind of shared no Australian left behind attitude of us being able to do this through action. And I thought to myself, shame on you, Scott Morrison. Shame on you to the alleged purported leaders of this country who are utterly failing to honour that spirit.
So I wanted to touch on that, the frustration that must come with this, because you talked about, and I love it, you know, shifting institution. And when you're shifting institutions, there must be some people who are just naturally resistant to that because change is scary and change is hard, and for whatever reason, they just sort of, you know, are resistant to it. How do you, as a person, actually deal with the frustration of coming up against, you know, you find a Coles and Coles go, yep, we're going to move, and then you come, you know, against Corporation B and they go, what are you talking about? That was just a one-off, or yep, we don't believe in it, or whatever their sort of objection is. How do you actually deal with that as a person leading an organisation like yours?
Well, I think you've cut to the heart of it, really, because that's the essence of what campaigning is. Certainly campaigning the way Greenpeace thinks of it. You know, if you start from a position that all of the solutions are, that the science is clear, and that the solutions are there to both get to net zero emissions by 2035, but also just to nourish and return our world to a state of flourishing and a state of humanity and nature in some kind of balance. So the science is clear, the solutions are there. So you ask yourself, well, why isn't it happening? And our analysis, and I guess the analysis of many, is that the reason why it's not happening is because power is unevenly distributed in our society. Systems have not been set up to achieve the aim of putting people and nature at the centre of decision making. And this has largely happened as a consequence of the influence of vested interests. So the job really is to shift vested interests. It is to overcome the influence of the fossil fuel lobby, coal, oil and gas in particular. And just to spell that out, there are still significant numbers of people who are not aware that it is coal, oil and gas that is overwhelmingly the greatest driver of global warming. So, you know, if you're serious about tackling global warming, the first thing you do is you stop using coal. And the OECD, for example, has said that all developed nations need to be off coal by 2030, at the very latest. So what do you do when you come across recalcitrant institutions? Well, you sort of expect to, because the system has been maladjusted. And the science and the art of campaigning, as well as the spirit of the movement, is all about how you do that. And so there will be a great difference between Corporation A, Corporation B, Corporation C. You will find some businesses will respond with a sort of shock and surprise and say, look, you know, gosh, we really didn't know. What do we do? And they'll just get on with it. And then you will find some who will say, well, look, no, we think we are doing the right thing, you know, go away, and we'll ignore evidence that actually what they're doing is pretty minimal, and that will require a campaign to change minds. And then occasionally there will be businesses that are where the whole business model is based on the destruction of the world. So if you are a pure play coal mining company, your business is the destruction of life on Earth. So you can try and persuade a business like that they need to shift their entire business, which is possible. You can go from being a coal mining business to being a copper mining or something completely different. But if a business is unwilling to do that, then it really does become a question of, well, how do you shift the environment so the business is no longer able to operate to destroy the world, and you actually have to in the end have a broader kind of reform. And that's where you move on to the demand side. So what is so fantastic about the announcement of Coles, and for that matter the announcement of Woolworths and Aldi, Telstra, Bunnings, Coca-Cola, Amatil and a whole lot of other really significant Australian companies that moved as a consequence of this Greenpeace campaign, is that they're changing the demand for shifting it from dirty coal to clean energy. And so what that says to, you know, pure play coal companies is, well, we might want to keep on doing what we're doing, but actually the demand's evaporating. So, you know, we're going to have to find a new way to make a crust. So you bring a very strategic lens to every occasion when you need to shift a major decision maker. You do that as effectively as you possibly can.
You touched on earlier, I just want to rewind a little bit about the power imbalance and the vested interests. Can you just explain for our audience who may not be quite aware of what you meant by that, of just exactly what you meant by in politics and in business, exactly how deep these sorts of roots go?
Yeah, absolutely. So we like to imagine that, and what should of course occur, is that politicians meet and make decisions in the public good, in the general public interest, and that they're advised by highly competent public servants who are advising them in about how to do that. And people are going to have different, legitimate differences about how you deliver things like health and education and so on, healthy environment and so on. But what happens within a democratic society is that different interests will try and get their agenda prioritised. Now, to some extent, of course, that's absolutely fine and healthy in a democracy. But what is not fine and healthy is when you have vested commercial interests who exercise far too much influence, which is the case with Australia's fossil fuel lobby, so the coal, oil and gas industry. And so the way this manifests itself is that you have a number of politicians who really quite overtly talk about their loyalty to the coal industry or the gas industry. We've had politicians wearing high-vis vests into parliament and hard hats and joining groups called the Friends of Coal. You know, the Prime Minister famously holding up a lump of coal in parliament and saying, you know, there's nothing to be afraid of. So there's that sort of overt declarations of loyalty. Then you've got large numbers of lobbyists who are sort of patrolling the halls of power. You have all of the advisors to all of these major corporations, so the lawyers, the accountants, the management consultants, who are themselves exercising power to try and influence the shifting of regulations and the changing of laws to benefit the coal, oil and gas companies. You have funding decisions made, so the billions of dollars of subsidies that go annually to the fossil fuel industry. Regulations are literally rewritten at the, or highly documented, rewritten at the behest of the coal, oil and gas industry from time to time. You have a kind of revolving door of people from ministerial officers to the public service to coal, oil and gas companies. You have peak bodies like the minerals councils and so on. So this all just acts to maladjust priorities away from the public good to the coal, oil and gas companies. And so let's just, you know, use a topical example of yesterday where you have the relevant minister, Keith Pitt, saying that the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility would not be allowed to support the creation of a wind farm because it wasn't in the national interest. I mean, this sort of stuff happens on an almost daily basis, and you find yourself just scratching your head that
shaking
it can't
your
possibly
head.
Be real.
Yeah.
I guess the natural question from that is, from their point of view, how is it justifiable in their minds? Is it purely, it sounds like there must be money exchanging hands if they're able to justify it. Like, how do you say that something like a wind farm is not in the public interest? How do they justify that? Either to themselves, to their constituents, to, you know, is it jobs? Is it money? Is it their long-term contracts that we're just not privy to that are sitting in the background?
Well, so I think both there's a system of ideas and a system of power. There's a lovely little book called Game of Mates, which describes the sort of informal way in which, you know, how the deals are done around here, mate, how power actually works here, mate. I remember being in Parliament House in Canberra years ago and having a coffee with a journalist talking about the undue influence of the mining lobby. And she sort of looked at me with, you know, some gentle condescension and said, look, you know, this is not a story, David. This is just how things are done.
Right.
So there's just a sense in which that, you know, that is just how power works. You know, the mines get dug and the power plants get built, sort of thing. And that's a system of power, but it's also just a set of ideas. Like, there are all these myths spread about, exactly how much employment is generated by the fossil fuel industry or exactly how much it's worth. It's invariably exaggerated. I mean, the Secretary of the Treasury is on record talking about the extent of the exaggerations. And then sort of sitting behind it all is just the sort of ethic of Shieldy Wright. That, you know, you read the plans for the future in which there's a sort of active imagination in which the climate change trajectory is just written out as if it wasn't a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But look, I think, you know, the question of what goes on in the conscience of every individual involved in these things is really a very, it's a very profound question. And you take a look at the federal parliament and you ask, well, who's prepared to stand up and say, you know, here's the hill on which I stand.
Yeah.
And if it's not this, if it's not climate change, which threatens, you know, we're on track for, you know, 3 degrees or slightly better or significantly worse by the end of this century, which is the, if my daughters live to the same length of time as my mother, it's their lifespan. If this is not a thing worthy of making a political stand on for all those people in the big houses, then, you know, what's it all been for them?
Yeah.
What's it really all been for?
Yeah. So this is the end of part A. Now, check out part B.